The reason it is entitled this is because it is trying to deal with, explain, and advocate the Roman Catholic system of morality, which is to say, God's system of morality. And the reason it is called Basic Morality 2 is because it is considered a continuation of an earlier tape called Basic Morality 1. In this tape, we shall attempt to deal with some of the sexual aspects of basic morality. Now, let me define the word morality. Morality means those rules and principles revealed by God to man, by which man is required to live. By required, I mean that if he does not adhere to these rules, there is a penalty. If he does adhere to these rules, there is a reward. One may call them, if they wish, the laws of behavior, or the divine laws of behavior that humans must follow. This is not to say that if one adheres to these laws, one is automatically saved. However, if one violates the serious aspects of these laws, that is to say, commits a mortal sin, that is, violates a serious aspect, or what is believed to be a serious aspect, with full consent and full knowledge, and one does not have the sin remitted sometime, then one is put into hell. And what that means is damnation. Therefore, morality, that is, adherence to morality, is a necessary part of salvation, but it is not a sufficient part of salvation. The reason it is not sufficient is because one must also have faith. One must also believe what God has asked us to believe, what he has presented as truth. Now, at this point, I shall make a slight digression in dealing with the concept of faith as part of morality. Although traditionally there is a dichotomy when one talks about these things, and one usually puts it this way: one must believe what is true, one must do what is right in order to be saved. Basic morality, however, really comes from faith. What I am saying at this point, in a certain sense, is theology is morality. You cannot know what is right to do, you cannot know what is wrong to do, unless you believe there is something beyond you which gives authority to what is right and what is wrong. In other words, there is a binding authority beyond you which requires you to behave in a certain way and to avoid certain behaviors. This is literally what we call faith. Now, there is, of course, and I dealt with this a little bit in the other tape, the concept of natural law. Natural law being that inclination or knowledge written on everyone's heart. That's a poetic way to say in every normally functioning human being, which advises him by matters of conscience and right reason that certain things are correct and certain things are not. These are the unspoken axioms or the unprovable axioms of human behavior. Some of them obviously are that parents should not kill their children, that torture should not be used for gain, right to private property, that people should be honest in their business dealings, that people should tell the truth. The list is endless. The point I'm simply saying is that even though we all agree on what these things are, there must be some agreement that there is a principle beyond human beings which makes these things correct. In other words, if, as an example, the torturing of young children were only a human concept, then at least in theory, all of the humans could get together, vote that it was now allowable, and then it wouldn't bother us. But of course, everyone understands that this cannot be so. No matter what we vote, and no matter what we say, no matter what we wish or what we desire, certain things will continue to bother us when we do them, and certain things will make us feel that we are in accord with this something beyond us. The something beyond us, of course, is God. And the mere fact that we all believe there are standards beyond us which are both right and wrong means that there is the belief in God. Now, to deny God, to say that God does not exist, that this something does not exist, and therefore that we can all determine our own morality according to our own whims, or our own rules, or our own political jurisdictions, or our own voting power, or through our own authority, is to deny God, to enter into a form of atheism. It is to deny natural law, which is possibly one of the clearest and most imminent proofs of the existence of God. And therefore, the faith aspect must precede the moral aspect. And in that sense, if one behaves exceptionally well, if one behaves in a good fashion, if he feeds the hungry and clothes the naked and does this and is charitable to his fellow man and honest in his business dealings, but yet denies the existence of God, if he says that he does this only for the purposes of his own desire or his own sense of feeling well, what he has done is made himself God. And his good works are, as Isaiah said, like filthy rags, because they are not done for the proper motive. A good act, a moral act, must be a good thing done for a proper motive. Now, of course, it is possible, and always has been, that one may perform an objectively bad act and still get merit for it. By objectively bad, I mean one that does not bring about benefit. The simplest example, of course, is where doctors performed certain medical procedures which they in their own heart and with their own degree of knowledge thought were good, but which actually did not benefit the patient. In this case, the doctor did something objectively bad, but he did it for a good motive, that is, the healing of the patient, the relief of the patient's suffering, simply did not bring it about. And this is why in morality, intention is so important, but it is also why knowledge is so important. Because once the doctor becomes aware of what is the proper medical procedure, he may no longer follow the improper one. Then the exact same act becomes sinful, while before it was beneficial. We hold it as axiomatic, that is, I cannot prove it, that all men are obligated to seek the truth. Because by definition, all men desire in their lives, when they see suffering, or when they feel themselves uneasy, to know the value system beyond them. That is to say, to understand and to know God's plan. And this is why we are compelled to come to morality, and this is why even those who are ignorant of it are ignorant of it through no excusable reason. In other words, they are culpable of their ignorance. Because God compels in all of us, through the trials and tribulations and sufferings of everyday life, and through our own desires through natural law, to seek him out. And if we seek him, as Jesus says, we shall find. If we ask, we shall be given. This considered is primarily introductory comments to try to establish a relationship of what basic morality is, the relationship between morality and faith, the relationship between morality and theology. Quite frankly, improper theology always leads to improper morality. Because you cannot misunderstand God when God has promised us wisdom, if we ask for it, as St. James says, and truth, as Jesus repeatedly promises us, and the Holy Spirit to guide us to all truth. So therefore, if we start out with the concept that God is not real, or does not keep his promises, or does not come to us and tell us what is right and what is wrong, does not give us truth, in other words, what we have started out with is blasphemy. And morality, again, is not ethics. Ethics is the set of behaviors proper for human beings in certain set circumstances, which are definitely not universal principles. As an example, in the United States, it was unethical at one point for medical doctors to advertise. Now, it is considered quite ethical for them to do so. Again, in the future, it may be unethical. These are sets of behaviors which vary from time to time depending on the profession and the people involved. But morality is by definition universal. It always applies to everyone to whom it can apply. Now, When we deal about sexual morality, what we have is the following situation, and I base it on the first few chapters of Genesis. When God created the world, he could have, at least conceivably to us, created the world full of creatures. But instead what he did was create the creatures, male and female, and told the creatures to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. When he created man and woman, he told them to subdue the earth. He didn't subdue the earth for them automatically, but he gave them the right and the power and the authority to subdue the earth, in other words, to conquer it, in other words, to fill it. Because Adam and Eve by themselves could not subdue the earth except in the area in which they were. Therefore, in order to fulfill this divine commandment, they would have to multiply, procreate, reproduce. The words we use are interchangeable. I'm sure you understand what I mean. The primary directive, therefore, the primary goal, therefore, of humankind is reproduction. Reproduction to as a form of creation, as a continuation of the creative process which went on for 6 days. God created for 6 days. On the seventh he rested, and on the eighth man took up the position. This is quite in keeping as a principle with what Jesus says. When he says to people, do not worry about what you will eat and what you will wear and what you will drink, I'll take care of that. And yet, he also rewards with heaven those who fed the hungry, clothed the naked, visited the sick. Why? If they were going to be cared for by God anyway, why the reward for those who did it? Why the punishment for those who refused to do it? The only way to reconcile these two passages is to understand that humans have the primary goal of cooperating with God to do God's work. When we feed the hungry and clothe the naked, we are doing God's will. We are taking care of his fellow creatures. That is our job. That is our goal. By definition, as long as there are still people who are hungry and naked and thirsty and in prison and sick and sorrowful, there are not enough of us doing the right thing. Or there are not us doing enough of the right thing. Now, there are two ways we can increase the amount of good in the world. One is to increase each one of us the amount of good we do. The other is to increase the number of people who each do the same or more amount of good. The proper way to do it, of course, is to increase the number of people and increase them doing more good. For this to be done, it means, number one, of course, reproduction. Number two, evangelization. Evangelization in the sense that no child is born a Catholic, although we use that expression, I was born a Catholic, I was raised a Catholic. Well, no one ever was. When you come out of the womb and when you were conceived, you were not yet baptized, by definition. Only when you are baptized do you become a member, a formal member of the Roman Catholic Church. Only then you receive the theological virtues which are brought about as a result of that sacrament. Only then do you become a true member of the Catholic Church. Now, even though you are a member, and even though you have received certain supernatural graces, tendencies, and infusions of virtues, you need to be educated. You need to be reared. You need to be raised. In order for this to occur, you should, under the best of all circumstances, be raised in a loving family with both a mother and a father, so that the mother may teach the more feminine Christian virtues, primarily those of compassion, while the father may teach the more intellectual Christian virtues, the doctrines of the faith. This does not mean to say that by any means these things are exclusive. I'm simply talking about natural tendencies, historical divisions, and what we all feel most comfortable with. The father is the head of the household. The mother is the heart of the household. And as I stated before, in the same analogy of talking about faith and behavior, your brain and your heart must both be accord with God in the proper relationship in order to enter heaven. Therefore, the proper goal of Christian people is the rearing and raising and reproduction of Christian children so that they will go forth to help subdue the world, to conquer it for God, and to increase the kingdom of Christ by converting one person at a time and bringing him into the church. Again, in order to do this, it takes a long time. Jesus set us a perfect example of this in the fact that his public ministry was 3.5 years long, approximately. He was an adult, an adult man at the time he began his public ministry, and he dealt with adult men. He dealt with religious Jews who certainly understood the concept of what the Messiah was. Now, nonetheless, he could not get his point across. Despite his frequent predictions of his dying and his rising from the dead, the apostles did not understand this. It did not sink in. When the women came back from the empty tomb, the apostles did not agree. And even after Jesus rose from the dead and appeared to them, and even after he instructed them for 40 days on the kingdom of God, it took the feast of Pentecost, the descent of the Holy Spirit upon them, the infusion of knowledge and virtue at that point through that specific miracle, before the apostles could go out and preach and convert properly. Up until then, they were not capable. Why? Because the mysteries of the faith are supernatural in nature, and they need supernatural sacraments to prepare the way. But, as people say, grace builds upon nature. Our natures are such that the more complex thoughts need to be learned over a period of time, unless, of course, as in the situation of Pentecost, God decides to infuse things. If you follow the history of St. Paul after his conversion, he went away for a long time, in which we do not know what he did, but apparently he studied possible spiritual growth before he started writing his letters and going on missionary journeys. The point is, the maturation process of a Christian to properly absorb the doctrines of the faith is a long one, and it is sometimes a difficult one. It is a progressive one, where what goes now will be built on what went before, and what goes in the future will be built on what is now. The educational process takes a while. Now, in human life, there are no guarantees, simply because of our free will and because of the accidents that occur, and because of the fact we can always reject the grace of God. But we work on the assumption that we can increase the probabilities of events occurring. This is why sexual activity, which has as its primary goal the reproduction of human beings, of Christians, of people to fill the earth, must be carried out only in marriage, and when marriage must last once until one of the parties dies. In other words, you cannot have remarriage. Because the reproductive concept, the raising and rearing of children as proper Christians who can evangelize, and the raising of Christian children is evangelization, can take place only in a household which has a father and a mother combined together through a union of love. Love for themselves, and a hierarchy of submission, and love for the children. Now, this is naturally understood in a following different way. When we feel love for one another, that is, a man for a woman for a man, it is a natural thought, that is to say, one that is in accord with God's plan, for us to desire to have sex with that person. We feel attracted to them. We desire to be physically close, and that physical closeness leads to a sense of intimacy, and intimacy leads to the inclination towards sex. Again, sexual activity is quite natural and good, but since sexual activity leads to reproduction and, of course, a bonding and an increase of love, and that is why I think in English we call it making love, it has to be controlled in the family system. Because if it is not controlled in the family system, we will have children being raised in what is now called dysfunctional families, or families which don't exist, single parent head of households. So that either the father will have to become the mother become the father, or one become both. And the child will not be raised correctly because he does not have both. Now, of course, I understand in this case that there are times when through no one's fault, a single parent family takes place. or one of the parents decides to abjure his responsibilities, and therefore the other parent has to take it over. I understand this perfectly. But I am talking about ideals, because morality always deals with ideals. What should be and what should not be? What is the goal you are shooting for? What is the goal you are aiming for? What is the goal you wish to achieve? That is the basis of morality, because morality is based on intent. Therefore, when one is in sex, it must be in marriage. Okay, I believe that position is clear. Let me drop back a little further. Why, therefore, should certain activities not take place outside of marriage? And by these I mean activities which are not sexual in their very nature, but preliminary to them. Without getting graphic, I believe everybody understands what I'm talking about. In other words, what about, to use, say, an example, cohabitation? That is, a man and a woman living together who are not yet married, or do not intend to be married. And we're talking about people who are not related, when I have a brother and sister, or a mother and son, or something like that. Why is this generally wrong? I say generally because when we talk in these matters, we talk about generalizations, and there is no case in which I can talk about individual guilt assigned to an individual person. I am not judging people in this talk. I am not saying who is a sinner and who is not. I am not saying who goes to heaven and hell. I am simply talking about the general principles of basic morality, and that is a totally different matter. I cannot judge how these principles are applied in each individual case. I cannot judge the degree of guilt. I can judge a person's words. I can judge a person's acts. Those I can point out if they're wrong. But again, the degree of sin, I cannot say. With that in mind, I return. The concept of cohabitation can, and frequently does, lead to proximities which induce a sense of intimacy from which follows sexual activity. And that is why cohabitation is wrong. It is not necessarily wrong in itself, but because of what it leads to. The technical word of something like this is an occasion of sin. The occasion of sin means a situation, a person, an event, an object, which under the circumstances it is encountered, leaves the person encountering it with a significant temptation which he finds hard to resist. Now, occasions of sin vary from person to person, depending on their taste, their inclination, and their degree of virtue, and their degree of being able to resist temptation. Some of us, by definition, being alcoholics, have difficulty consuming alcohol. We cannot control it. Others of us have no problems in this area whatsoever. To put an alcoholic as a night watchman guarding, say, a brewery, where he could drink all he wanted without getting caught, would be a terrible temptation and possible an occasion of sin. But to put someone who cares nothing about alcohol, doesn't like to taste the beer, and doesn't want to drink it as a guard, that would be quite different. This is exactly why in the Islamic countries, the harems were guarded by eunuchs, castrated males, because the natural conclusion was they would have no inclination to be tempted to have sex with these women. Well, the concept of occasion of sin sexually means that if you are on step A, which leads to step B, which leads to step C, and step D or E or F or anywhere, even up to Z, will actually lead to sexual activity, which brings about the possibility of reproduction outside of marriage, then step A has to be avoided. By the same token, certain acts of affection, certain gestures of friendship or intimacy, certain gestures of love are quite acceptable in our culture. And in this sense, one may say that, quote, the common morality has changed. They no longer give scandal. This is primarily because of how do each of the partners understand the activity. However, and I must make this clear, basic human nature has not changed. And certain activities, and again, I will not become graphic, certain activities are almost always a prelude to sex. And these activities must be avoided for those for whom it does lead either to the sexual act, or, even if it does not lead to the sexual act, the thought of the sexual act given consent to in one person's mind. Because we must understand that sin is committed in the mind first and in the body second. Sin is committed in the heart. As Jesus says, the man who looks at a woman with lust in his heart has already committed adultery with her. Sin is always an act of will in violation with God. Now, again, the degree of consent and the degree of sin is a separate matter I'm not dealing with here. I'm only talking in generalities and the basic principles. If an activity is not actually fulfilled in a sexual activity, but the lust is aroused to the point that it brings about the thought, the desire, and the mental consent for it, it is the same morally as if it occurred. Fortunately, it is not the same in the sense that the physical activity does not occur. Allow me to try to put this matter into context again. The primary goal of the human being is evangelization. Evangelization means increasing the number of true Christians, that is to say Catholics. There are two ways to do this. One is by reproduction, the other is by conversion. But reproduction, after the child is born, automatically entails conversion if you're going to raise a Catholic. This is a process which takes usually a long time if we're not talking about miraculous and we're not talking about saintly abilities. We're not talking about the type of person who can bring about an instantaneous conversion. We're talking about the average person. This long procedure should take place in a context of Christian unity, Christian family, Christian bonding, Christian love, which again is the concept of the family. It is only in a properly functioning family that the ordinary person, the average one of us, can bring about the completion of our assignment, the rearing and education of children correctly. And again, and I repeat this most emphatically, this is not to condemn or to point out that people who are in single parent households cannot raise Christian children. It is simply a more difficult task. And I advocate as a general principle, which I believe is attributed to St. Thomas Aquinas, that when one seeks to do good, what one does is seek what is good, not what is difficult. Always take the easier way to accomplish the way when it involves another person. It is easier to raise a child in a proper family than it is in a dysfunctional one. And that is the reason why certain sexual activities are prohibited by the Church. Additional copies of this tape, or any of our other tapes, may be obtained by writing to...
Our address is ARM 55 Palen, that's P. Paul A. L. E. N. Road, number 38, Hope... Well, that's one word, Junction, New York, and our zip code is 12533. Thank you for listening. God bless.
4226-4172. Tapes related to this subject matter are Basic Morality 1, Basic Theology 1, Basic Theology 2, and the tape on Faith and Hope. We would suggest that...